Welcome to episode 15 of Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and every Monday I publish a new podcast episode where I talk to someone that is helping to mitigate climate change, a climate champion. I learned something from each person, and I hope you do too. We are all in this together. My guest this week is Scott Anders, Director of the Energy Policy Initiative Center, or EPIC, at the University of San Diego School of Law. Scott takes us back to his early love of nature and birdwatching up through his work in developing climate action plans. He reminds us that what happens on Earth stays on the Earth. It is a closed system. Our activity has impact. And as we grow, we push against the edges of the planet's limits. Scott and his team helped to develop the City of San Diego's Climate Action Plan, which includes a goal of 100% renewable energy. The city is in the process of forming a CCA to help achieve that goal. Which brings us to the Climate Champions Learn a Term segment. Jeremy, can you tell us what Community Choice Aggregation, or CCA, means to you?
Lee, come on, give me a break. I thought you were going to challenge me with technical terms. I mean, community choice aggregation. Isn't it obvious? Look, in our world, communities, they do representatives, delegations, things like that to represent what they want. In this case, it's very, very simple. There's a community, they have to identify the things that aggregate them, the things that bother them about climate and the environment, the things that they want to fix. By getting a consensus of the community and knowing where the aggravating things are, we could decide what part of the climate is bothering them and then attach that to the causes and get them to stand behind fixing it.
Jeremy, thanks for taking us back to Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update, circa 1975, and doing Gilda Radner's Emily Latella bit, which I loved. It's aggregation, not aggravation. Never mind. Jeremy and I both do improv comedy. He performs with Comedy Sports in Sacramento. Also, he and his wife Jocelyn wrote a memoir about each of their experiences 10 years ago when Jocelyn needed a life-saving heart transplant. Spoiler alert, since then she wrote the book and ran two half marathons. If you are interested in purchasing the book, search for Krivat on Amazon. It's called In Sickness and in Health. Jeremy, CCA is a program that enables a government entity, often a city, to buy energy on behalf of its residents and businesses, instead of from the local utility. The CCA still pays the utility to move the electricity that it buys, since the utility still owns the wires and other equipment. The motivation to do this is the increased control, which can enable a city to reach 100% renewable energy quicker and potentially lower their energy prices. CCAs are growing in popularity and authorized in 7 states, with a number of others considering it. This is the second time I've included a Learn a Term segment, which may be entertaining and educational, but also delays the start of the champion conversation. Please visit my website at www.privatenergyinnovations.com and send me an email voting to keep Learn a Term or not. I would love the feedback. Scott describes himself as a hopeful pessimist and often refers to Herman Daly, co-author of For the Common Good, first published in 1989. 30 years ago, Mr. Daly was arguing to de-emphasize economics and to emphasize the environment and community. Solar was $6 a watt, 20 times higher than it is now. The Tesla Model 3 was truly science fiction. What was considered a once-in-a-century fire, hurricane, or flood is now a common headline. Not considering the economic cost of environmental consequences is not only unsustainable, but observably more expensive. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm sitting here with Scott Anders. He's the director of the Energy Policy Initiative Center, that's EPIC for short, at the University of San Diego. That's USD for short. We've known each other a while. We were on a lot of panels together, maybe 5, 8 years ago, and had very good discussions about the future of energy.
Yes, I recall.
I think they were really good.
I agree.
So, with regard to climate change, can you tell me about the meaningful moment for you that made you feel like you need to take some kind of action and get involved in some way?
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't point to a single moment. I think it's hard for me to find a particular point in time. Maybe it was more of a process. And so I guess early on when I was younger, when I mean maybe college, maybe
You're not
early in
young now.
college.
You're not young
No,
now.
I'm not young now, but when I was younger, I realized that. And so I spent a lot of time in the outdoors. When I was a kid, when I was about 12 years old, I had a friend whose family was into bird watching. And so I did a lot of bird watching, which means you're out in nature and you're watching birds and you're being quiet and, you know, whether you like it or not, you're being contemplative. I think I was a little bit loud and obnoxious at times, and the parents would say, "Shh, you know, you gotta be quiet." So anyway, I did experience a lot of that. And then as I got older, this was around 12 or 13, I was kind of a nerd, I guess, a bird nerd at 12 or 13. Still am, if you see my poster on the wall here with the birds of North America. So when I was in college, I started to realize, I think, that this distinction that people talk about between humans and nature is a false distinction. It's a false dichotomy. And that there is no real difference between, you know, humans and nature, or maybe to put it a little bit more concretely, is the economy, right? This is kind of what really solidified my thinking in college, was the idea that the human economy is really part and parcel of the environment. I've spoken, been done lots of presentations, either to high schoolers or to leaders in the region, and I challenge them to tell me one thing that they have or that exists that doesn't come from nature. The natural resources come from nature. And so if you sort of think about that as your backdrop, then this connection, so human activity has impacts, I guess, right? So in college, I was also influenced by a guy named Herman Daly. He wrote a book called For the Common Good. And he's an economist, kind of a heretical economist. You know, he said things and did things that most economists thought was kind of crazy. And so I think his simple premise was the Earth is a closed system. The only thing coming in is solar energy, and yeah, maybe some of that goes out too. But for the most part, it's a closed system. I like to say what happens on Earth stays on Earth. It's the Las Vegas theory of sustainability, right? If you create carbon dioxide, it doesn't go anywhere. If you create polluted water, it doesn't go anywhere. It's here. It just moves around. But so, you know, what happens here stays here. And if you sort of think about that as a underlying philosophy, then you start to think about what the impacts are. And so I would say climate change, this is maybe a long-winded way of getting around to climate change, because climate change is really kind of the ultimate issue, right? You know, we've been pulling carbon dioxide out of the ground at a rate faster than the atmosphere can deal with it, or the systems can deal with it. And so our activity, so back to Herman Daly, he basically said we live in a closed system. So his theory was live in a closed system. Human activity has impacts, and the continuous growth of human activity ultimately is going to bump up against the edges of this closed system. And that's where I think climate change is a perfect example, right? So, you know, we've been pulling carbon out of the ground for a long time, and we're starting to bump up against the edges of that closed system. So I look back and I think to myself, you know, this guy was brilliant. I mean, he is brilliant. But just he was way ahead of his time, and he also recognized that economics was a key player. In other words, the economic system is kind of what drives these human impacts. And you know, I hear a lot of people say, you know, it's you're either, you know, it's either the economy or the environment. And again, I kind of don't see the distinction. The economy is the environment, or it happens in the environment.
Hand in hand.
Hand in hand, hand in glove. It's this. It is, you know, you know what Herman Daly did in our class is he said, you know, this is what economists say. There's this circular flow of value. You know, I go to work, I get paid, I go somewhere and spend money. That helps those people get money. And then they buy my product that I make, and it's this circular flow. And he said, well, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens in the natural world. In the natural world, so the economy needs resources, and the economy needs a place to put the byproducts, right? And in the case of climate change, we're taking the natural resources of fossil fuels. The byproduct is CO2 and others, but let's just talk about CO2. And so the climate is, the atmosphere has basically been the disposal area for carbon dioxide for 150 years.
And take that as your philosophy.
Correct.
So tell me about a moment maybe where you said, I'm going to take action. Was there a moment like that?
You know, I'm not sure that there was, again, a spark because of the spark like that. So my process was, so when I came out of college, I was interested in environmental issues broadly. And somehow, and I can't even explain this, I kind of gravitated toward energy. And I'm not sure why. But at some point, I realized that energy could be a nonpartisan issue. Of course, it's hard for anything to be a nonpartisan issue.
It seemed like it was
days.
For a while.
Right. So I liked it because you could say, hey, you know, if you do energy efficiency in your building, you'll save energy. And, you know, that's good for your bottom line. It's also good for other reasons. And so that's how I kind of got into energy. And once I got into energy, I realized that that was the biggest, you know, the one of the biggest contributors to CO2 emissions. And so, I mean, you know, I'm not sure that, again, that there was a single spark. But when I took this job at Epic, maybe this is a kind of a turning point. If you're looking for I could tell
hey,
you.
I just think it's interesting.
you're looking for the hook, right? The turning point. So
the hook, yeah.
Yeah, you're looking for the hook. And so, you know, I'm not sure I ever had that like aha moment. It was a slow build, I think. And maybe there was a tipping point, but I would say that I was interested in climate. I was aware of these issues for a long, long time. In fact, a funny story is when I was the summer before my senior year of college, I was a camp counselor in Maine. So my job in camp was to take the kids on trips out of camp, camping, canoeing, which was just the best job there was. But you couldn't do that all the time. So in between, we had to teach the kids skills, building fires, you know, this kind of thing. And we also did these kind of environmental lessons. And I remember doing one on global warming. And so this would have been 1990, basically. And so I was telling the kids, you know, the earth is warming up and, you know, the ice is melting and the sea level is going to rise and, you know, it's going to be terrible and New York City is going to be underwater. And these kids looked at me like I was crazy. They had, you know, they were much more interested in building fires, I guess, local warming than global warming. But in any case, I remember. So at that point, it was in my mind, right? I was clearly thinking about it. But when I took this job in 2005, it's the Energy Policy Initiative Center. I had a background in energy policy, energy programs. So I came in thinking, yeah, we do energy, right? And, you know, a lot of the work we do is energy efficiency, renewable energy. So it's already kind of heading in that direction. But in 2006, the Global Warming Solutions Act, so-called AB 32, was passed. And that completely reoriented my strategic direction here. And we started to say, well, okay, let's flip the coin, right? Because it's two sides of the same coin. One side's energy, one side's climate. And so sort of in this position, that was really the pivotal point where we said, hey, we have to start doing some work in this area. And we started to dive into analyzing greenhouse gases and policies to reduce greenhouse gases. And so since then, I can say, if you're looking for a turning point, you know, I've been, you know, personally, but also professionally, very, very much steeped in this, where I was wanting to learn everything there was to know about the climate and how it worked and why this was happening and was it happening for real and how do I argue with people who don't think it's happening, et cetera. So, I mean, again, I'm not going to give you a single point, but I would say that somewhere in the, Somewhere in college, my interest was sparked, and that's when it started to build. And I would say in the mid-2000s is when I really hit it hard.
Most people I talk to say it happened over time. Last week, I was talking to the CEO of this serious technology company, and it felt like the vibe was very clean energy, even though they were in security and not energy. But the CEO was talking to me, and I told him about this podcast. He came across very much as somebody who does not believe there's an issue. Mm-hmm. I spent a good 15 minutes, I think, wasting his time and wasting my time, because mm-hmm. no matter what I tried to bring out to show this was an issue of real import, mm-hmm. he did not give an inch at all. He said, if it is an issue, then China and India should be focusing on it and not us. Mm-hmm. So when you meet somebody like that, I assume that you do, what are the things that you say to try to convince them?
Well, you know, I have ways to that I think are effective to communicate it. But let me start off by saying, at this point, I don't do that anymore. I don't argue anymore. I don't convince anymore. At this point, in my opinion, the science is clear. The consensus is clear. You know, it's time to move on. And so you got to lead, follow, or get out of the way on this issue. And I'm not going to spend my time trying to convince somebody that this is happening.
Okay.
However,
yes,
for your listeners and yes. for you,
thank you.
some nuggets of knowledge about how to deal with this. So
let me say,
yeah, yeah.
Some of the value of this, even though I understand a number of people have said, isn't it obvious by now? Mm-hmm. I get that. But for those of us that run into people that are asking this yeah, question, getting your perspectives can help us.
Absolutely. I apologize for the glib response. And
no, I like it.
Because it's true.
It's honest.
Well, that's where I am, right? And, you know, we spend our time here. You know, I remember when AB 32 passed and people started talking about greenhouse gases, there was a backlash of sorts. And, you know, my simple response was, you know, it's the California law now. Like, it's going to manifest itself in ways, and you know, you can try to change the law. That's one pathway, but you know, it is what it is, and we have to figure out ways to kind of reduce emissions to meet these targets. And here we are almost 14 years later, and our emissions are basically at the targets that were set back in 2006. So I like very simple analogies. You know, I'm a simple guy, I hope. And so, you know, I always think about, I don't know why moms get such a bad rap. You know, somebody's mom is
moms like, somebody, don't get bad raps.
No. Somebody's mom is like an astrophysicist, right? But you always hear people say, I wanted to say it like I'm talking to my mom, right? Sorry, mom. But here are a couple things that I think are useful. So I use the analogy of a fever. You know, you say, you know, if you get a fever, 98.6 is normal temperature. If you're 102 degrees-ish, you start to feel sick. You get a, you know, you have a fever. If you go to 104, it's, you know, you're really sick. If you go
life-threatening,
yeah. Right? And so those are relatively small changes in the average temperature of your body, but they can set off problems in the entire system of your body.
Your ecosystem is messed up.
Exactly. So the analogy of the body to the globe, you know, that's one way.
That's nice.
It's okay. I mean, I think it brings it down to a kind of simple level. The one I like the best, though, is the analogy to steroids. And I can't take credit for this. I can't take credit for the fever one either, right? That's been around for a while. But I do happen to like that one. So the steroid one goes a bit like this. So I give a presentation and I show a picture of Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire. And yeah. I show them early in their career when they're quite skinny, actually. I mean, it's pretty funny to watch or to see. And then the other side is Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire after they've had steroids. And I ask people, who are these people? Everybody knows. In fact, I sometimes forget who they are. And I say, what's the difference between the left side and the right side? And of course, they know it's steroids. And I said, do you think that Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire hit more home runs on the before steroids or after steroids? They always say, of course, it was after steroids. They hit more home runs. But the reason I like this analogy is that it addresses one of the key issues around climate, sort of climate trying to convince somebody about climate change, is that there's natural variation in the system. So before steroids, Barry Bonds went up, and over the course of a season, sometimes he struck out three times in a row. Sometimes he hit three home runs in a row. Sometimes he hit a single, a double. Sometimes he hit whatever, right?
You don't have cold days. It doesn't. That's where you're going.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah. So you have this natural variation. But what happens is when you have all this extra energy in the climate, it acts like steroids. And so you're going to get more extremes. You're going to get more home runs. So you're going to get bigger hurricanes. And so it's this, the idea of this, the climate on steroids. So I kind of like that analogy.
I like it a lot. I like it a lot. Thank you very much for that. I was at the Wildfire Summit.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, when somebody went over the data, at least the forecasted data, what's going to happen. And it's interesting because the average isn't indicative of how bad it's going to get. Mm-hmm. They spent a while talking about 2 degrees includes water temperature. And we have lots of water, and the water is not as dynamic as far as temperature change as the land. So the land will see a lot larger fluctuations in order to get the 2%. And also, it's not going to happen the same every day or every month. There are times when it's actually going to get cooler during the year, depending on where you are. So when it does get hotter, it has to make up for the water. It has to make up for the days when it gets colder. So we're going to see double the number of days that go over 100, or three times the number of days that go over 100. So there's going to be significant impact on specific days in specific regions.
I totally agree.
I don't call those home runs. Yeah. I kind of call them strikeouts.
Yeah, right. But so, you know, I guess another thing about this question. So we worked on a project. It was a consortium of folks here in San Diego. It was us here at USD, but it was the marine sciences folks. It was us here at EPIC. We worked with the San Diego Foundation. We worked with Scripps, scientists at Scripps, and we worked with social psychologists at CSU San Marcos. And the idea was, how do we use the best science and the best we can get from social psychology and education theory to educate our leaders about the impacts? And it was about taking these kind of complex, like what you're talking about, it's kind of complicated, right? And trying to boil it down into kind of, not sound bites, but more digestible bits. And that was a really, really interesting process. I learned a ton about the science, but also about social psychology. And so coming out of that, as much as I subscribe to the science and I kind of like to geek out and look at those reports, I'm not sure that that's going to convince people. And so in this project, and I've heard this since, that, you know, when you bring more facts to bear to bolster your position, you often further alienate the person you're trying to convince, and it doesn't convince them, right? It doesn't. So you can be armed with all the facts in the world. This was part of the reason why I kind of said, well, if that's true, then why am I spending my time, you know, throwing facts and figures at these people or whatever? I'd rather just say, you know, we can agree to disagree. You know, I'm convinced that the science is there. There's a pretty broad consensus. There's a global consensus in many ways. And, you know, I've moved on.
You have data, which you're saying may not work. You're doing something different. You're using analogies, which are very strong analogies. They map very well in some ways. And I think that could be persuasive. I've heard from a lot of people the need for storytelling. Mm-hmm. The ability to say it in terms of stories, because that is truly how to communicate.
I think it's a great idea. I was just talking to a colleague this morning about storytelling. Funny you should bring that up. We were talking about the musical Hamilton.
Love that musical.
A lot of people do. And yeah. How, you know, that you had kids, you know, middle schoolers rapping about Hamilton and
history.
Washington,
history.
Right, and Lafayette,
yeah, exactly.
and you know, it just, so that is an example of how storytelling can be very powerful. And it was, and the crazy thing is that these kids are sort of absorbing these historical and other lessons or facts or whatever from this story, and it's sort of osmosis. They're not learning history, they're rapping Hamilton, but in the process, they're kind of absorbing these lessons, which I think is really interesting.
Speaking of Hamilton, they sacrificed so much to build this country, mm-hmm. to separate and to build it on different fundamentals. They argued, they sacrificed their lives fighting a war. Mm-hmm. They sacrificed their reputations, their families' lives, so much to create something better. And to me, climate change is this opportunity for this generation to do some sacrifice. And I don't think we're capable of sacrifice in that way anymore, but I hope we are. I hope we're willing to sacrifice in some way. We're not talking about our lives. Maybe we're talking about money, although I think that the money part is starting to come around pretty well. But I think we should be willing to do something to keep the world as we want it to be and as we dream of it being, to go in that direction and not to let it fall apart.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot about sacrifice over the last, I'd say in the last 5 or 10 years, I've been thinking about this as an issue that's tied to climate change. It's tied to a lot of policy issues. And, you know, there's a long history in this country of sacrifice and what citizens are willing to do in the name of and in support of a bigger goal. We can look at the world wars and things that happened during the world wars. But I guess Herman Daly, he was a big influence on me. He called himself a hopeful pessimist. And I kind of feel a bit like that, right? So I understand that humans have great capacity for sacrifice, right? We've seen it. We know that during disasters, you know, actually, speaking of climate impacts, my house burned down in 2003 in the Cedar Fire.
Wow, I didn't know
which,
that.
Which, wow, so, wow. So if you think about there's an interesting little piece of history for you. So 2003, San Diego County, huge fire. 2007, another huge fire. These are 2003, the Cedar Fire was the largest fire in California history. And I thought, wow, that's a, you know, one for the ages. Like we were hit by the biggest fire ever. And now, you know, 15.
What is it ranked? 3, 4?
So, yeah. And in a pretty short amount of time, it's now pretty far down on the list. And so that's a pretty interesting trajectory of where things go.
But that's not a very positive story, but that's a story.
No. But where I was going with that was when the fires happened, people, the outpouring of support was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And you see it over and over and over. So you know that there's a capacity for this. The question is, how do you harness it and keep it going? I don't know. And I think that it is around a shared goal that everybody kind of buys into. Unfortunately, and this is maybe where that's maybe the hopeful side, the pessimistic side is, we're in a time now of great tribalism and partisan divide. And I'm not sure whether climate change is a unifying enough factor to bring out that positive aspect of our human nature. And I know that when I bumped into you at an event recently, you were talking about your own theories about kind of sufficiency. What do I need to be happy? And I would say that fire was a huge lesson in that regard. So maybe backing up a bit, my wife and I, we were Peace Corps volunteers in Africa. We lived in Mali. In West Africa. And that was a huge lesson in what do you need to be happy? Because we were coming from, you know, the richest country in the world, going to one of the poorest countries in the world, and seeing how folks live their day-to-day lives. We lived in a village for 2 years, and we were able to see that there was tremendous happiness. Also, there was a struggle, and it was tough to be them, but they managed to be happy with next to nothing. And so that was a huge lesson. So the fire is, you know, you lose everything you own, basically. And you realize what's really important. And you know, when you boil it down, and you hear this, you know, you'll hear this when there are floods, when there are fires, and people talk about this. First of all, we didn't die, right? That's the first thing. We lived. We and our kids lived. We had neighbors who didn't. There were 14 people died in the Cedar Fire. 3 were our neighbors.
Wow.
4 were our neighbors.
Wow.
And so, you know, what's most important? That's most important, right? And then when you go from there, to be honest, I think that the most important thing is the points in time that you capture in a picture, in a journal, in a recording, you know. Those are truly irreplaceable things. Everything else, for the most part, can be replaced. And I know that I've had lots of discussions with people about this. Well, my grandmother gave me an earring and earrings, and they were from her grandmother and her grandmother. And I agree, those are truly irreplaceable things, in a way. But when you it makes you think about what you really need, right? What do you really need to be happy or to be fulfilled?
I agree 100%. I've done a lot of thinking about it myself, as you said. Can you tell me about your role in mitigating climate change here at USD?
Sure. So we, just maybe a little bit of background on our center. So we're a research center here based at University of San Diego. We're based in the law school. Our mission is to train law students in the area of energy law and policy. We have courses. We have experiential learning opportunities, which are really interesting, where we have students work with agencies on particular issues, basically work in a consulting capacity to help them solve problems. We also do research and analysis, and the goal there is to educate decision makers. And so we've done reports and papers and that kind of thing, but we also do a lot of work here in the region with cities on their climate action plans. And so that's probably the most direct way that we've been engaged in mitigating climate change. And so we do analysis around what emissions levels exist. So what are the current level of emissions? And if we want to reach certain targets to be consistent with California state targets, what policies and actions would need to be enacted to get there? And then we estimate the greenhouse gas impacts and that sort of thing. So there's a policy side, there's a quantitative side. And so that's definitely an area that we've done some work in.
When you talk about helping cities with the climate change plans, can you get to some specific plans?
Sure. Yeah. So one of the more well-known ones is the city of San Diego has a well-known climate action plan. We worked with them on that, and it has pretty aggressive targets. It has a target for 100% renewable electricity by 2035, and they are currently pursuing a community choice aggregation program to try to reach that goal. And so that's one plan that we've worked on. We also are working currently with the San Diego Association of Governments to develop a framework for climate planning in the entire region. So working to develop protocols or methods, but also a pipeline of support for cities to help them think this through and to give them the support they need to develop these plans. And again, what I'll say about these plans, and maybe this is a success, I was surprised, I continue to be surprised at how legitimate they've become. I know that's a funny thing to say because we worked on them, but they've really taken on kind of a leading role in driving some of these policies, at least at the local level. And so you'll hear city council members in the city of San Diego and stakeholders in the city of San Diego saying things like, you know, we need to have better transit or better mobility options if we're going to meet the targets in our climate action plan.
Yeah, they refer to the targets.
Yes. To the targets. And so the targets have taken on a certain legitimacy, which is really interesting. So I think that's been rewarding.
So it gives them a goal to hit. Hopefully those targets do map to mitigating climate change enough in enough time.
Yeah, that's a good question. So in fact, we are kind of a think do tank or a think tank do tank, right? We are not just a bunch of consultants looking to get the next client. We're a research center. We're based at a university. So, you know, we have a little bit of a different take on things. And so we think deeply about these things and we talk a lot internally about these things. And you can see my whiteboard is completely noodled over. Sort of represents some thoughts in my head and conversations we've had. But we were just talking about this very concept. So let me tell you kind of an interesting tension in some of these plans and in some of California's policies. So the way that this works is that California has set annual targets, right? So it says in 2020, you need to be X percent below Y level. That means that technically the year before, if you did something really big, you'd meet your target.
Yeah.
But what we know is that the impact of CO2 in the atmosphere is an accumulating problem. And so that would lead us to believe or would lead us to think that we want as many greenhouse gas reductions as early as possible, right?
Yes.
And so I think that we're starting to realize this and starting to try to think of ways to communicate this issue of kind of the cumulative impact, right? So it's one thing if you know, a city adopts a CCA and then, you know, 2 years before their target, they get to 75% renewable supply. Well, great, they've met their target. But had they started 5 years earlier, they actually would have had a bigger impact in the climate. So that's a concept that we're aware of. And I think the policymakers at the state level are aware of too. But I think that locally in these climate plans, it's a fixed target in 1 year and everybody's driving to that year.
And doing it early is certainly better. But California alone cannot solve this problem. So California can meet the targets or not meet the targets. It is not going to change the outcome of climate change. What's so important about, quote, the targets, unquote, is that it's driving solutions. And the key thing is those solutions need to be repeatable by others in this country, by other cities, by other states, and by other countries. And if we can't get things that are repeatable, I think it's less important whether we meet our targets or not.
Well, the funny thing, Lee, is that the repeatable technologies that we need already exist, for the most part, right? So renewable energy, been a pretty important success here in California across the U.S., where SDG&E service territory is approaching 50% renewable. In 2010, it was about 11%.
But we are leaning on other states and other areas.
Sure. But I guess my point is that there's nothing holding back the rest of the country from adopting renewable technologies, right? That's a repeatable, renewable portfolio standard or something along those lines. That's a repeatable success. The only thing that's holding it back is, maybe economics or political will or something else. Energy efficiency, another one. So these are all repeatable successes. I would argue, though, that, EVs is another area that we're moving into. In fact, I remember one of our interesting conversations, you had said that there are these waves of technology. So the first wave was photovoltaics.
That's my wave theory, baby.
Yes, the wave theory. Yeah. Then it was and electric vehicles, and then the next wave was going to be energy storage. Is you still subscribe to that theory?
Electric vehicles, I think, are actually throughout the whole thing, throughout all the waves. Yeah. Because these things help them. For example, the higher you have a percentage of solar and wind, the more of a way to mitigate climate change an electric vehicle becomes, because it's using cleaner energy.
Right.
So to me, it's underneath this whole wave.
Yeah.
It's kind of the surfboard on top, maybe. Yeah.
So let me ask you a question. So this is something that I've been thinking about.
Yeah.
I agree with your theory, right? If California meets its targets,
you don't have to say it.
It doesn't mean anything, right? I mean, it really is. But what it's doing is it's driving policy solutions. It's driving technological solutions that can be spread and replicated. And California's also joined with other countries and foreign pacts, and we have a cap and trade system. So, I think the previous administration did a good job of thinking bigger than California. But ultimately, you're right. It's a global issue. And therein lies one of the big challenges. But let me ask you a question about what you just said. And I totally agree. So California's basic strategy is to reduce the amount we use through efficiency, either transportation fuels or electric and natural gas. The second one is to decarbonize electricity. And the third one is to electrify transportation and everything else we can possibly electrify. So let's talk about transportation. Or maybe we don't even need to talk about transportation.
Who's interviewing who?
Oh, that's a good question.
No, you can ask me.
So if we electrify everything, are we creating another potential problem? Because now we're prisoner, in a way, to the electric system, which has to be perfectly reliable, has to be secure. There has to be privacy along that system. And, I got to thinking when the hurricane hit Puerto Rico and the electric grid was out for so long, I thought to myself, well, what if everybody in Puerto Rico had electric vehicles? They would be in deep trouble. Even if they had localized storage, they would be in trouble. The beauty of fossil fuels and, if you can think about a beauty of fossil fuels.
You're not really asking me now.
No, the beauty of fossil fuels is that they are hugely energy dense, right? I tell the story of my father-in-law and I had to put a pipe in our backyard for like 300 feet. And we rented this ditch digger thing and we put gas or diesel, I can't remember what we put in it, and it just chopped up our backyard. Had we done that with our arms and shovels, it would have taken us a week. And so, fossil fuels are brilliant in that way. They're basically carriers of energy. And you can have a tank in your backyard full of gas. You can have tanks all over the place full of gas. So what do we do if we're all electric?
Today, long-term storage is oil and gas. We have to find a substitute that is renewable. We need a wave 4, there's a tremendous amount of money and companies focusing on long-term storage that is renewable. And I don't know whether it's going to be taking carbon dioxide out of the air and creating natural gas with it, or whether it's going to be a lithium ion or some other energy storage solution that's just very cheap and very dense, or whether it's going to be hydrogen created by excess solar and excess wind. So there's a bunch of potential solutions for long-term storage that will be renewable, but we must have it. I will say that if in Puerto Rico they had storage and local solar, then they'd be much better off, because even with the wires down, they'd be able to have some amount of their own energy, which they weren't able to have once the wires went down. So I would really like to see distributed microgrids as the way we begin to think about our system and how to get more of that. So I do believe that all these pieces that you mentioned are moving forward. But you're right, if one moves out way ahead of the other, it's going to cause a problem like it did in Hawaii.
So that raises the question. I mean, you know, we've slipped into energy here, which is great. I guess that's the other side of the coin, as I said earlier. But we're needing to think about building resilient systems going forward, not just in Puerto Rico, but look at, you know, we have this huge flood in the Midwest. We've had wildfires. We've had these natural disasters over the last, I mean, we always have them, but they seem to, these home run natural disasters we're seeing, we need to start building in resilience. And, you know, certainly microgrids is definitely a way to do that.
I'm a big fan. You mentioned one success, helping cities with their climate action plans. Talk about some other successes that you and the university have had.
I'm really proud of the team and the way that we've worked to make climate planning kind of an everyday thing in our region. We did the first greenhouse gas inventory in 2007 or 8. And it was the first time that anybody in our region, the whole county, had looked at where emissions come from. And our theory was you needed to do that in order to figure out how to address it. And we kind of knew what the answer was going to be, but it's nice to have an actual accounting of it. And I would give presentations back then, and people would, I would ask people, what do you think the biggest emitter is? And some people would say ships in the port. And I would say, no, in our region it's transportation. And by the way, fun fact, San Diegans drive about 40 billion miles a year.
Whoa.
That's why we have the transportation is the highest emitter. 40 billion.
Wow.
Miles a year.
40 billion
with a B. And you, of course, know how far the sun is from the Earth, about 93 million, say 100 million. So just to put that into perspective, it's a few trips back and forth to the sun every year. So transportation is a huge impact. But getting back to the success, so we've, over the course of, you know, 10 plus years, we've improved our methods and we've improved our way of thinking. We've improved the knowledge that we have around this. But I think at the same time, we've helped in our little way bring the IQ of the entire region up in this area of greenhouse gas emissions and policies and that sort of thing. So I think that, you know, that's a bit of a broad way to respond to your question, but I think that's something that we're proud of here.
Oh, that's awesome. By the way you're acting, I can tell this is personally important to you. Why is that?
Well, you know, maybe it's a hackneyed way of thinking about this, but I mean, I think that this is one of the biggest issues facing humans in this century. Maybe the issue, because it kind of, as the military says, it's a threat multiplier. So it may exacerbate other big problems like water and migration and sort of and other issues. So huge issue, right? And it's an issue on a scale that humanity have never dealt with. I can't think of anything that even comes close. It will require some kind of an international cooperation. We talked about this earlier about, you know, working together, coming together across. We're just talking about in the U.S. maybe, but we've also got to figure out a way to do that across nations and continents. And, you know, the Paris Agreement, for critics and lovers of the Paris Agreement, one thing is that we got a lot of countries to agree on something. Most every country.
But us now? No, isn't it every country?
Something like this. And so that's important. It's an important step. And so, but the personal, I would say, so it's a huge issue. And I have kids, and I know that that's where the kind of the hackneyed piece comes in here. It's like, you know, we have it's my kids and their kids and all future generations. It's not just about my kids. A lot of people don't have kids. It's about future generations of Americans, of humans. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about my impact, so, you know, right now I have two kids. My daughter's 18. If she has a kid in her 30s, that kid will live, you know, to well into the, you know, almost to 2100. So if I think about my footprint, so to speak, it's pretty big. And, you know, I'm thinking what legacy do I want for my kids? I don't have grandkids yet, but I'm getting to the point, I guess, that someday I will. Hopefully I'll be around to see that.
Me too.
So you have, you have this long footprint, this shadow of your time here that goes pretty far. And so I kind of feel like the question is, what is the impact for our kids and grandkids is a refrain we should be thinking about for a lot of issues. And it's interesting because I feel like, I guess I'm getting old when I can start talking about kids and grandkids, but I mean, I don't have grandkids, but just even thinking about them, but it's too late to be thinking about it when you have kids and grandkids, right? You should have been thinking about this, you know, back when the kids were in camp in Maine who wanted to light fires rather than talk about global warming, right?
Yes.
We need to start early and often, like the Chicago voting advice, vote early and often. We should be mitigating early and often, start as early as possible, and not wait until we're retired to say, I want to do something.
Yeah, well, to some extent, that ship has sailed.
I agree.
Right now, it's all hands on deck.
It's all hands on deck.
Yeah. So tell me about your vision for the future. What do you think the world is going to look like with regards to the climate change? What happened and how did we get there?
Yeah, there's been a lot of interesting discussion. There's been a series on the radio that I heard, and they're basically flashing forward to, I don't know if it's 2050 or 2100, and they're sort of explaining what it's like. And there's a lot of focus on the solutions.
Yeah, what do you think it's going to be like? And how come?
Well, I think that we will, I'm a hopeful pessimist, to again invoke Herman Daly. I think that we will develop lots of great solutions. The pathway that we're on now in terms of, you described your wave theory, I think a lot of that's going to happen. It's already happening. Your fourth wave is further out, but most of the other waves are basically, they're either happening or they're early phases of happening or they're on the sort of drawing board to happen. So I'm fairly technologically bullish about, you know, microgrids and the software needed to do that and to have, you know, real-time pricing and you know, signals from the ISO controlling my refrigerator and all that kind of stuff. I'm pretty bullish about that. But I'm not sure it's enough. It's going to be enough. And so, I think that this shift has happened for a lot of other people too, is that we need to be, it's not a measure of can we fix it or solve it. It's a measure of what's the most we can do to mitigate the damage that we're going to eventually have? Because I think it's inevitable. I think, and it's hard to know because we're kind of in the change or we're in the pivot point or in, right? So when we look back in 100 years, we might say, oh my gosh, it was the early 2000s or the whatever, the 1990s to the 2010s where this was really critical. We didn't realize it because we were in it. But I feel like I was really struck by something that James Hansen, he's a NASA scientist, climate scientist.
What did he say?
He said that if you think about all of the carbon that's already in the atmosphere and all of the carbon or greenhouse gas emissions that are latent within the system we have, in other words, they're already going to happen no matter what we do, that alone is probably enough to get us pretty close to these tipping points in the climate, right? So, you know, I feel like we need to be figuring out how can we continue the mitigation so that we can minimize the potential damage or the eventual damage, I think is really how we should be thinking about it. And then we should also be thinking about what are the ways to build resilience and to adapt to those eventual changes.
That's a great way to put it. I agree with everything you said. I was just talking to my brother Jeremy, lives up in Sacramento. He said, are we going to be able to stop their climate change from happening? I said, climate change is happening. It's already happening. There are already impacts. We have fires and hurricanes that, if not specifically caused by climate change, the impact was worse because of climate change. And that is only going to continue. And we just can't act fast enough. The technologies we have might be there and they're falling in price, but we're not going to get them in place in time to not feel significant impact. The importance here is we're just trying to make the impact less than it would otherwise be, and it's going to be really bad no matter what, but crazy bad if we don't do things.
Right, and I have to say, I'm left with this hopefully pessimistic ending, and I worry a little bit about what that says to, for my kids, or, I mean, literally, if they listen to this, and by the way, they definitely won't listen to this.
But they won't?
No.
Okay.
Are you kidding? I send my kids links and texts all the time, and they don't even open my texts, let alone listen to the last 10 minutes of your podcast. No offense. Kids these days. But I do worry a little bit about the message that conclusion sends to our kids. And so, but on the other hand, I think we need to go into this eyes wide open. We can't say to our kids everything's going to be fine. I think we need to say to our kids, look, it could be very bad. It could be worse if we don't do something, and we need to figure out a way to adapt. And I just don't want to be I don't want to be judged harshly by history when the kids say, why didn't you do something, right?
I mean, yes.
This is the old refrain of the old parents or the aging parents.
Okay. Do you have any questions for me?
I already asked you questions.
You did. Good.
No, let's see. Maybe I'll do one. I did already ask you the questions that I think I wanted to ask.
Do you have anything else you want to say before I wrap this up?
No, just thank you for inviting me. This was a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it. And I admire your passion and your application of that passion to this podcast.
Wow, that's very nice. Thank you. I'm going to wrap this up with a wrap. When you were 12 or 13, you were a self-proclaimed nerd. Instead of a favorite baseball player, you had a favorite bird. You quoted from the Common Good book, have you read it? Hey, Lee. The author was inspirational, Herman Day Lee. You had many excellent theories, some of them a little outrageous, like what happens on the Earth stays on the Earth, just like Las Vegas. Hamilton's an awesome play. The history lesson's real nice, but perhaps climate change is our time's sacrifice. The work you're doing in San Diego helps every woman and every man. You and your team crafted this city's climate action plan. Helping San Diego with goals is quite noble, but climate change mitigation is a problem that is global. Odds of a once-in-a-lifetime weather event are climbing even higher because the Earth is on steroids, just like Bonds, just like Maguire. Okay, that's it.
Great. That's fun.
Scott had some great analogies to describe climate change. First, when a human gets a fever, it may only be a few degrees, but just like the Earth, it can be life-threatening. And second, just like a baseball player on steroids won't hit a home run every time they are at the plate, climate change won't result in a fire, flood, or hurricane every at bat. But the home run record will fall. And when a home run is a natural disaster, it's time to get off the juice. If you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know. Scott is the director of the Energy Policy Initiative Center, EPIC, at the University of San Diego. EPIC is a nonprofit research center that studies energy policy issues and increases awareness and understanding of energy and climate-related policy issues by conducting research and analysis to inform decision-makers and educate law students. Communicating this important information is critical to mitigate climate change.